afternoon, everyone. The Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs, Finance, and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on the House Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is custom with this committee, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Before we get started, our committee legislative assistant, Ms. Doyle, will you take the roll?
Chair Eklund.
Present.
Vice Chair Zhang.
Present.
Representative Detmer.
Detmer, present.
Representative McDonald.
McDonald, present.
Representative Berg.
Berg, present.
Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Edelson. Edelson's excused. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Sundin.
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. Next on the agenda is approval of minutes from the February 10th, 2021 meeting. Every member should have received a copy of today's minutes in their inbox. I'm seeking a motion of approval for the minutes. Representative Sundin, what say you about the minutes?
I've examined those minutes thoroughly, and I would move approval of the minutes of the previous meeting.
Representative Sundin moves the approval of the minutes from February 10th, 2021. Any comments or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the minutes say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. The minutes are adopted. First on the agenda today, House File 351 from Representative Cagle. I will move that House File 357 be laid over for possible consideration in an omnibus bill. Representative Cagle, you may introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 357 is protections for pregnant and nursing workers. And so it just makes some modifications to pregnancy accommodations and also allows for break time for to express breast milk. I think, and then also there's make sure that the breaks for that purpose would not reduce any compensation, and then also make some changes to WESA, which is the Women's Economic Security Act, to accommodate pregnant workers for more frequent restroom breaks, allowing them to sit, not lifting heavy objects, being temporarily assigned to new positions or different positions to accommodate pregnancy. I had a very difficult pregnancy. It was not fun at all. I had preeclampsia and had to be very careful on what I did in the last stages of my pregnancy. And then also, making sure that you have the opportunity to pump if you need to, making sure that you can keep that breast milk production supply up is very vital. Especially if you're not with your baby every day or, throughout the day. And so having that opportunity is really key. And so with that, I will turn it over to my testifier, Kate Peruschek, I believe, from the Department of Labor and Industry.
Ms. Peruschek, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 357. My name is Kate Peruschek, and I am Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. The legislation before you today mirrors Governor Walz's budget recommendation to improve employee rights to pregnancy accommodations and to express breast milk in the workplace. The proposals aim to support expectant and new moms so they can safely work during their pregnancies and continue to breastfeed upon returning to work after the birth of a child. The Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry is responsible for the enforcement of the Nursing Mothers and Pregnancy Accommodation Laws, two of five provisions of the Women's Economic Security Act, or WESA, under DLI's authority, passed by the legislature in 2014. WESA is a comprehensive employee protection law designed to protect and promote opportunities for women in the workplace. Since July 2014, the department has completed 95 investigations of alleged violations of the Women's Economic Security Act, 21 related to pregnancy accommodation, and 19 to the Nursing Mothers Law. Many of the employees who contacted the department regarding pregnancy accommodation were ineligible because they worked for an employer with fewer than 21 employees. As such, it became clear that a change in law was needed to ensure protections were inclusive to more workers. The reasonable accommodations required under the law are minor, yet very important to the health of pregnant workers and their babies. In 2020, DLI contracted with the Wilder Research to survey Minnesota women about their knowledge of the Nursing Mothers and Pregnancy Accommodations laws and extent to which employees received pregnancy or nursing accommodations in the workplace. The survey found more frequent restroom, food, or water breaks was the most needed pregnancy accommodation, and half of the surveyed women received this accommodation in the workplace. 16% needed but were not provided more frequent restroom, food, or water breaks. Feeding accommodation and limits to heavy lifting were identified as a lesser need and were provided to about a quarter of the women surveyed. Yet many Minnesota women identified seating and limits to heavy lifting as a needed accommodation that wasn't provided by their employer. The survey knew why the accommodation was not provided. The law requires an employee to request a reason. Or perhaps the employee worked for a small employer and didn't have the right to an accommodation. Regardless, these accommodations are reasonable, short-term, no or low cost, and all pregnant workers should have a right to request and be provided an accommodation, irrespective of the size of their employer. A reasonable accommodation supports pregnant employees so they can continue to work safely and earn a paycheck. The Wilder Research Survey also queried Minnesota women about their experiences expressing breast milk in the workplace. Our survey found that a quarter of nursing mothers identified having to stay late to make up break time used to pump as a major or minor issue, and 50% identified not being able to take or schedule breaks when needed as a major or minor issue. Improving the law by requiring break times to be paid and clarifying that a worker has a right to multiple breaks that may, rather than must, run concurrently with breaks already provided addresses these issues. Importantly, the proposal supports initiation and duration of breastfeeding. Being able to express breast milk at work supports continued breastfeeding, ensures adequate milk supply, and benefits the health of both mother and baby. In addition to supporting working mothers and the health of Minnesota children, these proposed changes will also benefit employers. Benefits include improved employee retention, loyalty, productivity, and lower turnover. I would like to emphasize that the department's primary aim as the agency responsible for enforcing these provisions is to educate employers on their obligations and help them achieve compliance. As I mentioned, since 2014, DLI has received 19 complaints alleging failure of an employer to provide proper accommodations to nursing mothers. In each case, the agency quickly educated the employer about the requirements of the law. When a violation was found by DLI in an investigation, employers under review promptly came into compliance. Notably, no employer has been the subject of repeat complaints to DLI for violations of any WESA provision. The administration supports House File 357 as it improves workplace protections for pregnant and nursing employees and benefits maternal and child health. Under this proposal, more nursing mothers and lactating employees will be able to take time needed to pump at work without losing pay, ensuring employees that choose to breastfeed can continue to do so upon returning to work. The proposal improves equity by ensuring all pregnant employees have the right to request a reasonable accommodation at work, regardless of the size of their employer. Thank you for allowing me the time to testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner, for your time. Please stick around in case there's any questions after all the testimony is done. Next up is Karen Fogg from Section Manager of Maternal and Child Health, Minnesota Department of Health. Ms. Fogg, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Karen Fogg, the Maternal and Child Health Section Manager at the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm joined by my colleague in support of House File 357 on the protection of health for pregnant employees. Pregnancy affects people in different ways. During pregnancy, some employees may face few limitations on their abilities in the workplace, but other employees may have some limitations that necessitate accommodation. Some people have pregnancy complications such as high blood pressure, gestational diabetes, or ongoing all-day nausea and vomiting, even extending far beyond the first trimester in some extreme cases. For others, pregnancy may exacerbate an existing medical condition and may need to seek input from professional healthcare professionals more frequently. As the previous testifier just mentioned, the accommodations may relate to lifting heavy objects. Activities that require balance, like climbing a ladder, can be even dangerous in pregnancy for some people. Additional time to eat, drink, or use the restroom more frequently, and limits on standing for long periods of time. These accommodations will allow pregnant employees to continue to contribute productively in the workplace and remain employed throughout their pregnancy. Including the protections around pregnant employees during this time contributes to the overall health and well-being of the employee and their future children, as well as their family. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Fogg. Please stick around if there's any questions on the bill. Next up, we have Marcia McCoy, research scientist, Minnesota WIC program, Minnesota Department of Health. Ms. McCoy, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Committee. Thanks for hearing from me this afternoon. My name is Marcia McCoy, and I work for the State Office for the Minnesota WIC Program. And we would just like to affirm our support for House File 357. The difficulties experienced in maintaining breastfeeding after return to work are disproportionately felt by parents that work in low-income occupations, and this bill would be helpful in helping parents who are just as likely to begin breastfeeding, but less likely to be able to achieve their goals. Therefore, so thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. McCoy. Members, are there any questions? House File 357. First Amendment asks Representative Cagle, is this all your testifiers, Representative Cagle?
I believe so.
Okay. That's all I have on my list. All right, members, any member questions to House File 357? Well, I will comment while we're waiting for questions. When my spouse went, when we went through the breastfeeding thing with our kids, she was a school teacher at a small Catholic school. And it was nearly impossible for her to pump because accommodations were not made at the school. They had the smaller number of employees, but she was very stubborn. She made sure that they made space for her and found out where they could do it. So I applaud the women that want to take care of the best health they can for their child, and also make sure that we can work on these type of things moving forward. So I'm not seeing any member questions. Oh, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if there's a difference or if you could explain how this is different than the policy that the governor proposed.
Representative Cagle or possibly Commissioner Prusik.
Mr. Chair, I would turn that over to Assistant Commissioner Prusik.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the governor's proposal amends the law a bit differently in that it changes the definition so that they apply to the leave provisions, also pregnancy accommodation. So it would change the pregnancy and parental leave law to lower the number of, if you work for an employer with one or more employees rather than 20 more employees, you would be eligible for an unpaid leave of up to 12 weeks. That also applies to the school conference leave and ability to use your own accrued sick time. And then it lowers the what's called the attachment to employment or the tenure requirements from 12 months you would have worked, had to work for the employer for 90 days instead of 12 months.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Chair.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a comment in favor of this. We know that we have an economy that is increasingly asking for two working parents. This is a time when there are very few households that are not dual income. And so it really becomes an equity issue. I remember working 12-hour days in retail management when I was pregnant and then pumping in a dressing room after giving birth, but there was no way that we could live without my income. And so as we're considering this, I just want to make sure that we're sort of thinking about this through the lens of equity and the fact that this is extremely necessary just in terms of workers not being discriminated against or having consequences doing what is very natural and necessary and the best thing for their babies. So I am just wholeheartedly in favor of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Berg. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cagle, I won't speak too much on this issue. Don't have much experience, although I'm a father of three boys, but I let my wife handle that part in the beginning. But just curious as to, in the language, it refers to small businesses. And I'm a small business as well, but I just wondered what your definition of small business, how many employees constitutes a small business as to the large business.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't have the language right in front of me. Maybe would Assistant Commissioner Krucek be able to answer that for me?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald. So what is changing in the law is currently to be eligible for a pregnancy accommodation, you have to have worked for an employer with 21 or more employees. And by moving the statutory language to the nursing mothers section of statute, it now applies to employers with one or more employees. So all employers would be covered.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Ms. Perchik. So Representative Cagle, I would presume that, you know, some smaller mom and pop shops that will have this particular issue, you know, certainly will be accommodating to the mother, but then also that I would imagine that the mother will be accommodating to the businesses as well, and they'll work together. You know, I trust the businesses and employers and employees to work together. So I don't think there'll be an issue with some of your smaller one woman shops, rather. Would you agree with me on that, Representative Cagle?
Representative Cagle.
You know, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I that's the hope. But I think, you know, we want to make sure that, I know when I was pregnant and working in a very small nonprofit, my employers were very accommodating to me, probably because there was, you know, it was a women-run nonprofit. But and everybody had children, so I think they quite understood. But I think, you know, that's the goal. We want to make sure that folks are working together, but we also want to make sure that moms have some protections as well.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Cagle. Well, women are just amazing, and I know my wife and my mother multitask 20 things at a time. So. It's amazing what they can do and how well they do it, and much better than men sometimes. So that's all I have to say. Just hope my wife's watching those nice compliments.
We hope she is too, Representative McDonald.
Yeah.
Any other member questions? Representative Cagle, you have any final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. You know, one thing I learned in the past few years is just really how hard work it is to be able to breastfeed a child. And even if you're not, you know, breastfeeding, just to also make sure that your milk production stays up. It is really difficult. At least it was for me. I know some people, you know, are able to produce more, but making sure that you have that time to keep that production up is great, is very much needed. And this is, you know, this bill has also brought me across the street to the Senate. I got to make some friends over there. I know Senator Coleman and I had a conversation about this bill, and I believe she's going to be carrying it in the Senate. And she was able to share some of her experiences as well, being a nursing mom. And so I think that this is just something that we really, really need, and want to make sure that our little kiddos are getting the best nutrition they possibly can. So I thank you for hearing this bill.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. I will renew my motion that House File 357 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Next on the agenda is House File 108, Representative Knorr. I will move that House File 108 be referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Representative Knorr, you may explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good afternoon. This bill prohibits employers from requesting or using credit information as a condition of employment for hiring, firing, promotion, or compensation determination, or in any other way, shape, or form that impacts the conditions of their employment. Can you imagine being denied a job because of your credit information due to financial hardships, especially during COVID-19 pandemic, where many people are unable to pay their bills due to being unemployed or receiving an employment benefit that does not pay all their bills? Can you imagine being denied a job because of inaccurate reporting on your credit information, which often happens to so many people? This is a process that is being used by many employers to deny well-qualified candidates an opportunity to have a job, or maybe to enable them to pay off their debts. Credit information includes a credit score or history, credit account balance, payment history, or saving and checking account balances or account numbers. This is truly an invasion of privacy for individuals. There are several exceptions included in this bill, Mr. Chair. If the information is required under state or federal law, or if there is a valid business need for the information, the bill also excludes financial institution and credit union employers, peace officers, financial manager positions, and positions involving routine access to confidential financial and personal information, large cash transactions, or a financial fiduciary responsibility. This bill provides a private civil cause of action for violations. An injured employee may seek damages as well as an injunctive relief and reasonable attorney fees and costs. The data shows that when credit information is used in hiring or firing, it disproportionately impacts Black, Indigenous, and people of color. So, Mr. Chair, this is more about also an equity and ensuring that people don't misuse the use of credit information. Prospective employees are not customers of the credit reporting agencies. They are the product. Credit reporting agencies package up consumer data and sell it to lenders, employers, landlords, insurers, and other businesses. Mr. Chair and members, today credit information is not only used by lenders, but everyone who needs it. Thank you so much. This is an important conversation that we need to have and protect employees from misuse of credit information. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm ready to answer any questions on this bill.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. Any member questions? Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Knorr. I really appreciate you bringing this. When I was a public defender, I worked with folks when I went into the private practice, I was worked with folks on getting expungements for the record, and we would get the expungement and they would have that taken care of and still have a hard time with employment. They would get a job and then an employer would run their credit and they would have a hard time getting a job. And so the way I've seen firsthand, the way that these credit checks are overused and really prevent in the way of people working and being good, getting good jobs and employees. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the enforcement mechanism in the bill and how we make sure that that employers and folks are in line with the policy when it's passed.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think as you have seen, we've given the employees the right for private action if they're harmed by employers. So this gives them the opportunity to actually file a civil case against the employers so that there's a remedy for that. So this is to make sure that employers do not overuse the credit information in determining employees, eligibility for employment or even promotion. There are individuals who may be promoted or even the firing process or compensation that you cannot get more income just because of your credit information. And that's something I think we all want to make sure that there's that protection for the workers and protection for prospective employees.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just really want to, I'm fully in support of it and really grateful for your advocacy on this.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenman, you're the sunlight is coming right through your lens and blinding us. If you could turn your computer a little bit. No, that's good. Yeah, it wasn't blinding us, but we couldn't see you as well. Say, Representative Noor, just curious as what scenarios that you have found in exploring and researching the bill. I don't not support it. I think it's probably a good idea not to judge a character by the, at least in employment, by his credit score, although we have to be careful. I'm glad that your bill does offer some exemptions. There are some careers, I suppose, in businesses that we should be careful about, especially such as a banker or maybe a legislator. But what research and instances or scenarios have you uncovered that you could share with us that that your bill would be able to help folks not have be affected by this credit score?
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald. I think this is being used by many employers. In fact, I had someone who was denied an employment merely because of having credit information being used against them. I've also helped many individuals who are applying for jobs where they're required to consent that their credit information can be pulled by the employer. I don't know why we need a credit information to determine individuals' skills or employability. So this is not something that I'm just talking merely because of a bill. I have seen this impact individuals in my district who brought this issue to me. And also I've seen firsthand when employers are requesting on a job that is not any of those exclusion that I've indicated, that by just moving boxes, working in a warehouse, you don't need to have that credit information at all.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Noor. I agree with you. First of all, I was ignorant on the issue. I wasn't aware that 40% of employers do hire on the credit rating. So I certainly see that this is something that needs to be remedied and appreciate your work on it, Representative Noor.
Thank you, Representative McNeil. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other member questions? I will comment briefly on this. Chair Noor, thank you. I appreciate you bringing this bill, and I'll just use an anecdotal story. I don't know how many times I answered the telephone at my former place of employment when we had creditors and others calling employees, coworkers that I had because they'd run into credit issues. They were some of the best employees that you could have had. They always showed up for work. They signed up for all the overtime, probably because they had credit issues, maybe, and had to pay bills, I'm not sure. But by the same token, if those highly skilled labor folks had wanted to transfer to another facility, their credit history, whether it's a fault of their own or others, could have been used against them for finding new employment. So Chair Noor, I appreciate you bringing this bill, because just because people get into credit problems does not mean that they are good or bad potential employees. Chair Noor, do you have any final comments?
No final comments other than this is a good bill. We should all support it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Noor. I renew my motion that House File 108 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll?
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Eklund, yes. Vice Chair Zhang.
Yes.
Zhang, yes. Representative Detmer.
Yes.
Detmer, yes. Representative McDonald.
Yes.
McDonald, yes. Representative Berg.
Yes.
Berg, yes. Representative Bliss.
Yes.
Bliss, yes. Representative Edelson. Edelson excused. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, yes. Representative Greenman.
Yes.
Greenman, yes. Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Nelson, yes. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Poston, yes. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Raleigh, yes. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin, yes. And we have 12 ayes, one excused.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. Chair Noor, you're on your way to judiciary. Final bill on the agenda today is House File 403. Representative Herr, I will move that House File 403 be referred to the General Register. And Representative Herr, I understand there's an author's amendment. Can you explain the amendment and then we can adopt it? Representative Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Chair, there is an amendment. This amendment reflects the productive conversations we've had with members of the business community. The amendment clarifies that, one, a job applicant and an employer can still engage in a discussion around pay expectations, and two, an employer would not be in violation of the bill if they simply provided a job applicant information about wages and benefits. The Department of Human Rights is supportive of this amendment, and I ask for the committee's support.
Thank you, Representative Herr. I will move the adoption of the A1 amendment so the author can get the bill in shape she wants it. All in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion is adopted and the bill is now before us as the author intends. Representative Herr, you may explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair Eklund and members. Today, I'm presenting House File 403. That's the Preventing Pay Discrimination Act. This bill is about taking Minnesota one step closer to closing the pay gap. The pay gap is very real in Minnesota. According to the recent report from the National Women's Law Center, we rank in the bottom half of states in how bad the pay gap is for women of color. House File 403 will help us close the pay gap. The Preventing Pay Discrimination Act protects a job applicant from being required to disclose their previous pay when they are applying for a job or negotiating a wage. That said, this bill does allow a job applicant to voluntarily disclose their pay history if they wish. So with House File 403, we essentially say that an employer cannot ask a job applicant about their past pay or require that they disclose their past pay. We do this because research shows has shown that the pay history question perpetuates the pay gap by anchoring down a woman's pay. And we have all the statistics around this, and I wasn't going to go through the details of it, but I'm seeing that we have some time here. I would just like to talk a little bit about this pay gap. And we know that women in Minnesota who is on average making 80 cents less on the 80 cents on the dollar for what a man makes, or even lower for a woman of color. Imagine what it'd be like to try and negotiate your salary if an employer is basing your new salary off of past pay. By ending the pay history question, we help prevent a job applicant from having their future wages anchored by their past pay. This allows us to break the cycle of pay discrimination that can follow women sometimes throughout the entirety of their career. Before I finish, it is important to note that 18 states, including a diverse group of states like Alabama, Colorado, and Massachusetts, have already passed their own pay history question bans, and they've seen a 6% increase in pay for women and a 13% increase for Black workers. So it is about time Minnesota takes a step to close the pay gap. And I would just like to provide one quick example of just this happening in real life, right? I was looking at both my husband and my own pay history, and I'm going to age myself here, but I graduated college in 1995. He graduated 2 years before me, even though he's older than I am. It took him 2 more years to graduate. By 1997, I had already worked 2 years, and he had just started, and I made 28% in pay more than he did. By 1998, I made 45% more than he did.
But we get to a couple years later and I'm making 18% less than he does. And this is an apples to apples comparison because we both have an undergraduate in finance, went to the same university. Throughout this, our career, we both ended up with master's degree. I have an MBA. He has a master's of science in finance. We were both in the financial sector. So it's not like I'm comparing two different people in two different sectors with different degrees, right? And by the time we get to 2006, I'm making 46% less than he is. And by 2009, before I decided to become a stay-at-home mom, I was making 52% less in my pay than he was. And that within a 15-year period, I went from making 28% more than he did to making 52% less than he did. And that because he kept increasing in pay and my pay, I don't know why this happens, but he, you know, even for some reason, my pay kept getting based off of my past pay. And that wasn't necessarily happening with him. We were both moving jobs at the same time. And yet my pay became increasingly lagging in his, even though I had more experience. And if you talk to my husband, he would tell you that I am actually the smarter of the two. And so to us, it just doesn't seem to make sense. But I just wanted to share my own personal life experience around that with all of you as well. And so I just want to thank you for letting me present this bill. I have a couple of testifiers here today, and I would like to turn it over to them. We do have, and so Chair Eklund, if you don't mind, I would like to turn it over to my first testifier at this point.
Thank you, Representative Herr. First up today on testifying is Professor Jill Hasday, University of Minnesota Law School. Ms. Hasday, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chairman Eklund and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me. My name is Jill Hasday. I'm a distinguished McKnight University professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. I teach and write about sex discrimination and constitutional law, among other subjects. In my time today, I'd like to make one simple but fundamental point. Asking job applicants about their pay history perpetuates pay discrimination. I'll start with some historical background before describing the current state of the law and the need for legislative action. Before 1963, it was perfectly legal to pay women less. This type of discrimination was pervasive and out in the open. For example, Help Wanted ads would list one salary for male workers and a lower salary for women doing the same job. Many people hoped that the Federal Equal Pay Act of 1963 would end pay discrimination between men and women. But 58 years after the law's enactment, an enormous wage differential persists. The median earnings for women working full-time and year-round in 2019 were just 82% of men's full-time year-round earnings, with Black women earning just 63% of white men's earnings, and Hispanic women earning just 55%. The latest studies estimate that America's wage gap for white women will not close until 2055, for Black women until 2133, and for Hispanic women until 2220. One important reason for this wage gap is that employers frequently ask job applicants about their pay history before deciding what salary to offer. This widespread practice means that workers often cannot escape pay discrimination by getting a new job. If a woman's boss pays her less than men earn for doing the same work, the consequences can reverberate for a lifetime. Discrimination early in a career can lock someone into a permanent cycle of unequal pay. Unfortunately, federal law does not prohibit employers from asking job applicants about their pay history. Instead, federal law accommodates, even facilitates the practice. Employers sued under the Federal Equal Pay Act for paying women less will commonly defend their unequal pay practices by contending that they set salaries by relying on pay history. The United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, which covers Minnesota, has accepted this argument, holding that it doesn't violate the Federal Equal Pay Act to pay women less if the employer determined pay scales based on pay history. I'll repeat that because it's important. Federal law does not stop employers from paying women less for doing the exact same job, so long as the employer can point to the women's job history as the reason for the discrimination. The ability to rely on pay history provides employers with a ready-made excuse for underpaying women. But efforts to amend federal law to prohibit employers from asking about job history have so far been unsuccessful. a growing number of states and localities have responded to this problem by enacting their own laws to bar employers from asking job applicants about their pay history. These laws are aimed at ending the cycle of pay discrimination so that everyone can receive equal pay for equal work. The laws benefit women and anyone else with a history of being underpaid. To date, approximately 18 states and 17 localities have prohibited employers from asking job applicants about their pay history. A 2020 study by researchers at Boston University School of Law found that when states enacted pay history bans, employers were more likely to list salaries in their online help wanted ads, and that pay for job changers increased by an average of 5%, with pay for female job changers increasing by an average of 8%, and pay for African-American job changers increasing by an average of 13%. In other words, enacting a state pay history ban made workers as a whole better off while simultaneously reducing both gender and racial wage gaps. Minnesota should join this reform movement. Every Minnesotan deserves equal pay for equal work. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Hasday. Please stick around for questions if there are any. Thank you. Next up is Rebecca Lucero, Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Commissioner, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, Chair Eklund. My name is Rebecca Lucero, and I am the Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. So we are the state civil rights enforcement agency, and the agency is committed to ensuring that every Minnesotan can live lives full of dignity and joy, free from discrimination. That's why I'm excited to speak with you today about House File 403, the Preventing Pay Discrimination Act. Representative Herr and Professor Hasday already laid out everything about this really, really well, so I'll be brief. But the bottom line is the bill would help prevent pay discrimination from taking place when a Minnesotan applies for a job or negotiates a salary. This is a very simple bill. It simply says, don't ask an applicant to disclose their pay history. That's it. Nothing complicated about it. There are three reasons that I'll highlight why it's important to be intentional about eliminating the pay history question to ensure past salary is not being used when offering pay. First, women are persistently paid less than men with similar experience, qualifications, and seniority for the same job. And as Professor Hasday laid out, it's even worse for women of color. Second, the pay gap in Minnesota has not narrowed at all over the past 5 years. All the work we have done in Minnesota to come back after a brutal recession and housing crisis, and the pay gap between men and women still hasn't narrowed, and COVID appears to be exacerbating this problem. We need to do more. We need to be intentional. Third, it works. As was laid out, the states who have eliminated the pay history question saw an 8% increase in pay for all women and a 13% increase in pay for Black workers. So it works. Bottom line, when future salaries are anchored to past pay, gender and racial pay gaps will follow Minnesotans from job to job. This locks someone into a cycle of unequal pay, potentially throughout their entire career. In fact, on average, women in Minnesota lose an estimated $400,000 in lifetime earnings due to their pay gap. Women of color lose more. It is a very easy bill to comply with, which is demonstrated by the many employers who have already started to make this change. I have hired many employees myself throughout my career, and it's easy to comply. I simply do not use salary history when making an offer. So when someone applies for a job, I consider their qualifications. I consider their experience. I consider the market, but I don't ask about their salary history. It's a simple ban on one question to help eliminate this pay gap. I really want to thank Representative Herr for authoring this bill and Chair Eklund and the committee for giving this critical bill a hearing. Our department is excited to support this bill and help bring Minnesota one step closer to closing the pay gap. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Lucero. If you could stick around if we have questions, I'd appreciate it. Next up is Erin May Quaid from Gender Justice. Ms. Quaid, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Erin May Quaid, and I'm the Advocacy Director at Gender Justice. We are a legal and policy advocacy nonprofit that work to advance gender equity through the law. Thanks for having me today. So we already know that there are wage disparities between men and women in Minnesota, and we know the disparities are even worse between men and women of color. Hmong women in Minnesota earn 55 cents to every dollar a white man does. Native American Indigenous women earn 54 cents, and Somali women earn 44 cents. And so when employers rely on an applicant's prior history, as my previous testifiers have said, their job disparities or their wage disparities follow them throughout their career. And this topic is even more pronounced knowing that every job loss in December, 140,000 jobs were lost in the nation in December, were lost by a woman. And so with December's job losses, almost 45% of the over 22 million jobs that were lost in March and April due to the pandemic of last year, they have not returned. And we are in what has been dubbed a she session. And for many families, women leaving the workforce has been simply an economic decision. She leaves because statistically she makes less than her male partner. And so while there are a lot of solutions we need to address the alarming number of women who are exiting the workforce, House File 403 would ensure that when women do reenter the workforce, their prior pay discrimination does not follow them and depress wages. Previous testifiers noted that research has shown salary history bans are really effective in reducing wage gaps, but a law is only as effective as it is enforceable. And so I want to specifically mention that rebuttable presumption is entirely appropriate in this bill and actually a really good thing. The goal of House File 403 is to ban the practice of using past salary to determine future salary outright. And so rebuttable presumption in this case just makes this law enforceable. I know you all received a memo from the Minnesota Employment Law Council that said something to the effect that it would be difficult or for an employer to be fully compliant to prove that they weren't discriminating in using past salary and could result in unjust liability for employers operating in good faith and with an intent to comply with the law. I respectfully but very forcefully disagree with that. The goal of this law is to fully prohibit the use of prior salary history to determine future salary, period. It's actually not possible for employers to operate in good faith and also use prior salary to determine future wages. And that's why rebuttable presumption in this bill is distinct in the Minnesota Human Rights Act, because the Minnesota Human Rights Act names the actions that we want to prohibit. So for example, the Minnesota Human Rights Act doesn't prohibit employers from firing any pregnant employee. It just prohibits them from firing pregnant employees because they are pregnant. And so House File 403 seeks to prohibit all employers from using prior salary to determine future salary all of the time. In fact, this information is actually very harmful. We know that a job is worth what it's worth, and it's not dependent on how much you made before. The last thing I'll say related to that memo is that the MELC memo said that if employees give salary history to potential employers, then the employers will be liable. That's not what this bill does. What this bill does says that if any employee gives salary history, if the employer uses that salary history to determine pay, then they are liable. So if they don't use salary history, if they are given that, and they don't use that to determine future pay, then they are not liable. Again, the goal is to fully prohibit the use of salary history in determining pay. So in summary, we know that there are wage gaps in Minnesota. We know that we have to do a lot to close those, and House File 403 would encourage employers to de-bias their hiring processes and make sure that applicants' prior salary is not the basis for determining the compensation they offer. It should be the public policy of this state to encourage hiring systems that do not perpetuate wage inequalities, and this bill is a huge step forward. So I urge your support for House File 403 to reduce the gender and racial wage gaps in Minnesota. I'll stick around for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Quaid. First up, Representative Raleigh.
Well, thank you, Chair. I do have a question for the author. So as I'm looking at this, and I'm an employer, and I want to make sure that I'm going to be in compliance when this goes into effect. It says that use of past salary to set future pay is prohibited. Could the author please walk me through if an employer offers $60,000 per year to a potential employee, and then the employee says that they previously made $80,000, and the employer then says that they can't hire them, under the rebuttable presumption, does the employer then have to prove why they didn't hire the employee and prove that it wasn't because of the pay gap? Mr. Chair.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Raleigh, for the question. I am going to actually ask Commissioner Lucero if she could respond to your question.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Raleigh, for the question. So assuming that you as an employer did not ask about their pay history when you made that $60,000 offer, you instead considered your, like, what you were able to pay, their experience, maybe their education, as long as you were considering all of those pieces, then you are fine to make a decision based on $60,000 on what you could pay them. Importantly, subsection C says very clearly that an applicant can voluntarily disclose their information, subsection D. Nothing prevents a person from bringing, subsection C, I was correct, sir. So nothing in this subdivision shall prevent an applicant for employment from voluntarily and without prompting disclosing pay history for the purposes of negotiating wages. So they brought that up on their own. There's nothing that the employer needs to do in that situation. They use the correct reasons for making the decision.
Representative Raleigh.
Mr. Chair, so then it goes into the question of, at what point is it a request for a negotiation versus a violation of this law? Where does negotiation end and violation start?
Representative Herr or Commissioner?
Chair and Representative Raleigh, thank you for the question. So if you are using their history of their pay as one of the factors for what you are offering, that's a violation, period. And that's where it ends, really.
Representative Raleigh.
Mr. Chair, I want to make sure that I understood that. So if an employee voluntarily discloses what they're making in an effort for the negotiation to move forward, because I want this employee, and we then come to a middle road, I'm offering 60, they say 80, and we start moving up the pay, or maybe I don't move up the pay, but I give them additional benefits like 3 weeks off in the Bahamas or something. I've been creative throughout the years in offering things to employees. What I worry about is where the negotiation becomes a violation. And right now, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but you just said that if we start the negotiation and I use any of the data about past pay, that then becomes a violation. Did I mishear you, ma'am?
Commissioner.
Chair Eklund, Representative Raleigh. So the statute makes it very clear that any voluntary disclosure is completely allowed, and that you're able to then, as an applicant, disclose that as part of the negotiations. Now, the original $60,000 that you offered was not based on or anchored into their previous salary, and that's what we're trying to prohibit right there. I'm excited for the opportunity. I'm confused by the opportunity where someone's making $80,000 and they're moving to $60,000 as a starting salary right there. This is actually going after the situation where somebody's making $10 an hour and the market rate for a new position is for $15 an hour. But because you know they're making $10 an hour, you offer them $11 or $12, and you're relying on that past salary of $10 to pay them more at $12 or $11. But not what you would have offered or what the position was actually worth. That's $15. That's what this bill's trying to solve.
Representative Raleigh.
Mr. Chair, I understand what you're saying at the lower than $15 an hour rate. I happen to not be in that particular category when I hire employees. Would it be the opinion of the bill's author that employers will now need to post what it is that they're making as an offer prior to an employee applying for the job so that they don't get into the problem of rebuttable presumption?
Representative Herr or Commissioner.
Chair Eklund and Representative Raleigh, I appreciate the question. I don't know how much more simple the language in this bill can be. If you are not basing somebody's pay based on what they made before, there is really clear language about how you move forward. You know, I have to be really honest. I've hired people when I worked in the private sector. We always know what market rate goes for somebody. And I'm not saying that all employers do this, but I do know that we will always try to get somebody at the cheapest price possible, which means we base it off of their past pay. We know what the market rate is. We know what the ranges are. We use that to how we negotiate with somebody. We never give them really, you know, the high end unless we absolutely have to based on their past pay, right? So like, I guess I don't know where the confusion is coming in from this. I would just like to maybe ask if I know that Ms. May Quaid also had some comments that she wanted to make on this particular topic, and if Representative Michelle Lucero has anything else to add, but I would like to just, you know, see if they each have something they wanted to add to that as well.
Ms. Quaid.
Mr. Chair, Representative Herr, you explained it very clearly. Subdivision C of this bill actually exempts using salary history from negotiations for salary. So if you paid somebody more because of what their previous salary was, that would be exempt from this. And Representative Herr clearly explained, you know, when people post jobs and they hire for a position, they know how much they're expecting to pay. It's based on market rates and instead of being based on someone's previous history.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to ask questions.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Although it does seem to be a simple bill, a very simple bill and uncomplicated, as the Commissioner says and Representative Herr, that rebuttable presumption is not as simple and is questionable. And I'm wondering how many other discrimination laws that have that nomenclature in it, because it does assume guilt on behalf of the applicant, perhaps, or on behalf of the employer, it can be. So that particular wording does mess up a little bit and doesn't make it so simple. So just wondering how many other laws, discrimination laws, puts that in there, which does complicate things, there's no doubt. We know that, what that means. And would you be willing to, Representative Herr, because I am very aware that there's bipartisan support for this, but that particular rebuttable presumption does offer a sticking point to some folks. So if you could address those two issues, that'd be dandy.
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Eklund, and thank you, Representative McDonald, for the question. I did have a conversation with MELC on this when the bill first came up before judiciary, prior to the judiciary hearing. I'd say that I would like to maybe ask Commissioner Lucero if she could address this, as she can probably do it more succinctly than I can.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. Thank you, Representative McDonald, for the question. So actually, rebuttable presumption is a standard concept in all anti-discrimination law. It is very familiar to both employment and labor attorneys that do this work every single day. So in practice, a rebuttable presumption means that if an employer is found in violation of House File 403, it will be their responsibility to explain why they use the pay history question to determine a job applicant's wage. Nowhere in the statute language does it say they would be found guilty immediately. It's just a rebuttable presumption. It sets a clear standards for employers and job applicants. Every anti-discrimination law that we use, Minnesota Department of Human Rights, has a rebuttable presumption built into the very framework itself. Well-established case law.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, thank you. Fair enough indeed. That was a good explanation, and I appreciate that. The question then I would have would be to, in that rebuttable presumption, what safeguards are there for an employee to slip up? I mean, in time, employers will know about the law. They should. Good employers should study the law each year or each July, whenever they take effect. But there has to be some time that will have to lapse and to give some benefit of the doubt to that employer. So what safeguards in the bill, maybe Representative Herr or Commissioner, that gives the employer the benefit of the doubt, you know, strike one, strike two, strike three, you're out kind of mentality?
Commissioner.
Great. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. So first and foremost, education and outreach is something that's very important. to our agency. We do it all the time. It's very well received. We would really make sure that all employers know about this change in provision. This is also something that, of course, the employment, both defense and plaintiff bars are well aware of. They represent their clients and they do a phenomenal job. So certainly they would get the information out about this. We have been intentional about having an effective date that's a little bit longer to ensure that education and outreach can occur.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Then one more question for Ms. Mayquaid.
Please proceed.
Just question now, a lot of the talk has been women issues. I'm sure, I think that this has happened to men as well, but in your expertise and your the organization that you belong to, would this pertain to men as well, that you certainly it affects a man who's applying for a job as well and discriminated against perhaps? Just your thoughts on, I'm sure this law covers both men and women.
Ms. Mayquaid.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, that's a great question and actually covers every single person in the state of Minnesota. A really, really great example are men who traditionally work in like care fields. So there are a lot of work that is sex segregated. There are more women who tend to work in that field than men, but there are men that do work in that field and then they get paid lower because as an entire industry, it's valued at lower work. And so if a man is moving out of that industry into a different industry, if they were basing his past pay off of that work, he would still get paid less. So this would cover every single person in the state of Minnesota to be sure that anytime they experienced pay discrimination, it wouldn't follow them from organization to organization or industry to industry.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Ms. Mayquaid. Mr. Chair, that's all I have for now. My battery's low, so I have to go and plug it in. But I'll be listening.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm grateful to get back to the need and the importance of this bill, which is the workers. And I wanted to sort of ask again if you could, you know, I was struck by the, I think you said 44%. That the numbers of the pay gap for Somali women, for Hmong women, for Native women. And also, I think when we think about this, and I think Representative McDonald makes a good point, when we think about implicit bias in as it relates to workers of color, to men and women and folks of all genders. And so I just wanted to, one, just give you a chance to repeat some of those statistics that I think are really important. And the reason that this feels like a very eloquent and simple first step, which is we should be paying people based on the job, not based on anything that they, their past employment and that past sort of cumulative implicit bias, explicit bias, all of that stuff. And so just wanted to see if you could just repeat those numbers before about the gaps that we're actually trying to eliminate, because it sounds like this is a really effective way to do that.
Representative Hur.
Chair Eklund and Representative Greenman, thank you for the question. I am going to have Ms. Mayquaid repeat the statistics that she spoke to in her testimony.
Ms. Mayquaid.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, thank you for giving me the opportunity to repeat them. So in Minnesota, all women, the wage disparity is 83 cents to every dollar made by a white man. For Hmong women, it's 55 cents. For Indigenous or Native women, it's 54 cents. And then for Somali women, it's 44 cents. And with Hmong, Indigenous, and Somali women, we also know that they are concentrated in high-risk essential work pools. And so women in Minnesota are actually facing what we call the dual vulnerability of being both laid off at higher rates and concentrated into high-risk essential work fields and also paid the lowest. Additionally, every single job loss in the United States in the month of December was lost by a woman. So we had 156,000 job losses. Men gained 16,000. So it was a net loss of 140,000, and that was lost by women. Additionally, Black women left the labor force in December, having the largest one-month drop since we had our last recession. There are 2.1 million fewer women in the workforce now than there were about a year ago. And it's like almost the entire population of Minnesota that are women, right? It's like that number of women are leaving the workforce. So we are in a she session. We did not come back after our last recession, and we have to do a lot of work to make sure that we can after this pandemic, and House Bill 403 is a really, really good place to start.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. And actually through this conversation, I have heard and talked a lot about this issue before. I hadn't been thinking about how the pandemic will also impact this, and particularly as folks, and we have seen in both this committee and I think in workforce, the impact that it's having on the low-wage workforce, and who is getting laid off and losing their jobs and how that's gonna impact salary history. So just really appreciate hearing more about that too. It hadn't been thinking. So thank you, I fully support this bill and I appreciate you bringing it.
Representative Frederick, you had your hand up. Did you have a question or did you take, or are you good?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to make a similar point that Representative Greenland made about how I appreciate that there's an aspect of this that is just focusing on workers and that the value of a worker should not be determined by their gender. Like, that is completely ridiculous to ever think about in that regard. But it also is very clear that there is work to be done in that regard. So I just want to say thank you to Representative Herr and everyone else who's working on this bill.
So I don't see any other members' hands up. I will make some comments on the bill. Representative Herr, thank you for bringing this bill. I think it's about time that we address the pay gap. I know there's been a lot of talk about doing that, and it's certainly something that needs to be seriously taken care of moving forward. One of the members of our committee mentioned earlier that women are amazing. They can multitask and do all kinds of things. It's about darn time we start paying them for what they're worth and make the pay scales equal. Final comments, Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. I would just like to share one story with all of you today before I conclude. This year, I was working with closely with someone I care deeply about. He had been searching for a job for 5 months. He hadn't been unemployed in over 20 years, but wanted to know how to navigate negotiations with prospective employers. So he called his prior employer and asked them what type of information they provide to companies looking to verify employee information. A representative in the HR department for this Fortune 100 company, headquartered here in Minneapolis, told him that they provide begin date, and ending salary. To his surprise, a private sector company was providing what he thought was personal data that he was always told could not be disclosed. I mean, they were discouraged from even talking about their salaries with other employees within their company because they said that was not acceptable practice. He asked if providing salary information was common, and the company responded that each company does it differently, but they choose to do it in order to protect themselves. Now, I don't know what they were protecting themselves from, but what I see in this practice is that if you are from a specific demographic that has traditionally been underpaid, this practice continues to keep you underpaid as your next employer almost always bases your new salary on your old one. I know this because I worked in the private sector for 15 years, and in that time, I hired employees and followed HR practices from posting positions to making an offer to prospective employees. The balance of power lies in the hands of employers. No longer allowing this practice for asking pay history will shift the balance of power to a more neutral place, a place where an employer will pay an employee based on the value that person brings to the job, based on information they gathered from reviewing the candidate's resume, the interview process, and reference checks. Mr. Chair, members, I urge support of House File 403 as it will eliminate the pay gap disparities and hopefully bring us to a better place where there's equity in pay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Herr. I will renew my motion that House File 403, as amended, be referred to the General Register. Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll on the bill?
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang.
Yes.
Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
Aye.
Detmer, aye. Representative McDonald.
Aye.
McDonald, aye. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Bliss, aye. Representative Edelson. Edelson excused. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin, aye. And we have 12 ayes and one excused.
Representative Herr, you and House File 403 are on the way to the General Register. Members and staff, first off, after last week, there's a real reason why our committee administrator supplies an annotated agenda. I should not have had a roll call vote on that amendment. We should have just put the amendment in the shape that the bill in the shape that the author wanted. So I sincerely apologize, and I ask the committee administrator now to provide my script with a 16 font so I can make sure I see everything there when I'm doing it. So with that, next meeting is tomorrow, February 17th. We have four veterans bills on the agenda. Members, we are running a little bit low on numbers of veterans bills that we have. So going forward in committee, we may end up having 2 days of labor bills as the weeks go forward, depending on what bills are introduced in the coming weeks. Does anybody have any questions for myself or staff? Seeing none, we'll adjourn. We'll see you tomorrow.